I would say that artificial general intelligence doesn't exist. Artificial intelligence, to me, is not a specific defined term. It's very vague. I still hear people saying unbiased AI model. It's absurd. Machine learning and AI is inherently biased, generally more biased than humans. You know, Elon Musk is a smart guy and he's an expert in many things, but he's not an expert in this field. We find hard to find information in financial text and corporate disclosure. Our mission is corporate accountability through information transparency, and everything we do revolves around that. We're really looking to become the Bloomberg of financial text, really that ubiquitous tool to access, parse, and understand these reams of information.
Welcome to the Generation Hustle Podcast, the show that explores the world of business, entrepreneurship, and culture, all centered around the millennial. I'm your co-host Sherrison alongside my good friend Amin, and this week we're exploring the intersection of financial disclosure and artificial intelligence. Episode 60 is with Chris Benatti, co-founder, CEO, and lead developer at Bedrock AI. Bedrock AI are experts and innovators in the adaptation of language models to financial text that facilitate a unique quantamental approach to reading and understanding SEC filings. So in other words, they use underused, unstructured data sources to understand and predict earnings management, accounting problems, and outright fraud. We talked to Chris about her journey from accounting as a CPA to founding Bedrock AI. She details the importance of machine learning in the financial markets and how investors and companies alike can benefit from its use. This was an incredibly insightful conversation that we hope you enjoy.
So today on the podcast, we have Chris from Bedrock AI. And one, obviously, thank you so much for joining us today. You have a very interesting story that we're obviously going to be talking about. An accountant turned coder and now also developing a platform called Bedrock AI, which is helping a lot of companies, you know, find that and extract that useful data out of, you know, these hugely like complex 10Ks and stuff like that. So it's amazing to see what you guys are doing.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So let's just get right into it. So, you know, it's quite interesting going as a CPA myself. So I understand your story and what you've been through. You have a career pivot where you went from the accounting industry, from a traditional public accountant to now a pretty damn good programmer. So, you know, can you talk to us about kind of that journey and how you made that transition from going from CPA an accounting firm into, you know, working on code full time?
Yeah, I think people were actually kind of somewhat surprised when I left audit because I was one of the people who didn't hate it.
Oh, okay.
One of the three.
Yeah.
But so I have always been very, very interested and passionate about statistics, economics, and securities regulation.
So
I wanted to go back to school and do a master's degree in econometrics was my first sort of, you know, what I originally wanted to do when I left audit. So I started, you know, taking a whole bunch of stats classes and this, that, and the other thing. And on the way, started getting into coding, which I loved. And I, you know, I fell into a bit quicker than some of the other stuff and ended up doing a degree in data instead. But I think, you know, a key part of the transition for me was there's, before you start coding, there's this perception that people who code are all Zuckerbergs.
Yeah.
But once you start hanging out with enough developers, you start realizing that, you know, like you don't have to be somebody who started coding at 12. To become good at it or learn it. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's simply not that hard. And I think a big barrier to a lot of people, including CPAs, is just the mental barrier of I've never done this before.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite the transition. I personally tried to dabble in Python a little bit. This was maybe a couple of years back when I had some time off during the winter. And for me, it was just, I guess just cause I didn't have a proper learning environment, just to kind of take me through the, you know, steps of what I should be doing first. Like I was trying to learn NumPy's, Panda and all that kind of stuff. And I was just like, oh, this is overwhelming and all that stuff. So I tried to take a Coursera course and I think I just went too advanced too early. And so what would you say, you know, like a lot of CPAs such as myself, have, you know, passions elsewhere, say outside of accounting or, you know, typical finance. So, you know, how would you tell them and what would you tell them on saying what steps would you take to kind of transition into a different career and or a different field?
Yeah. So first, don't sell yourself short. So, I mean, from your experience, you know, I found the first 2 months of working in Python to also be quite overwhelming.
Right.
But after you get through that initial push of learning, it does end up getting just a lot easier, a lot more intuitive. And I think, you know, as CPAs, we have a lot of spreadsheet experience, a lot of numerical experience. So there, I think, you know, it's probably a bit easier to pick up, you know, languages like SQL and database querying, understanding structured data, having data intuition, et cetera. So, you know, we're not starting at nothing, keeping that in mind. So the way I approached it, I did a one-year degree. I learned a lot better in person. I try to do a Coursera course, I know myself, I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah.
And that was really important to me. It cost me a bunch of money, but I think it was worth it. I successfully, you know, fully made the transition from auditor to data scientist. And, you know, like all through that degree, I just essentially ignored the courses that weren't specifically coding or specifically stats related. If I had a business course I had to go to, I would literally start the assignment 3 hours before it was due. And really just prioritized working on the skill sets I wanted to learn and needed to learn.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important point. It's just like, for me, I'm a very active person in terms of learning in person as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that environment will enable anyone to learn a bit better. Like, again, I took a Coursera course on Python and halfway through it, I'm just like, I can't do this anymore. It's just like repetitive information. It was just too much. And so, you know, you've mentioned careers, in data, now you're a data scientist, technically, I would say. And so what were some things that maybe candidates looking to get into the data field should kind of invest their time in and maybe help them stand out against their peers for some data roles? Because, you know, every company is hiring a data scientist these days, it seems. So what would be your best advice for those individuals?
My advice for anyone getting into data right now is to focus on the less quote unquote sexy areas of data science. There is an enormous, enormous need for machine learning engineers, for data engineers, for people sort of earlier in the pipeline. And I think, you know, even if you do want to be a data scientist, working on that aspect of your skill set is so important.
Right.
Now, as someone who hires, there is this focus of a lot of people in school who are working or focusing on that last step, which is, you know, tuning a sexy model at the very end of the pipeline,
right.
Which is what, you know, 5% of your work in real life. And most companies, you know, aren't hiring specifically for that end.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the skills to do data engineering, you're not able to understand the data you're working with, understand the pitfalls, you know, build some infrastructure around the models you're building to actually get it to production. Those are the skill sets that if you learn them, you know, you're going to get a job. Whereas there's a lot more competition in the high-end machine learning research data science.
Yeah. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Even if you kind of look it out into a finance lens and career, a lot of people just want to build those financial models, but they don't learn how to build a foundation in terms of the skill sets, like assumptions, the kind of things that go into it. They're just like, yeah, we'll raise money because, you know, our model just plops out, whatever. So I think it's really important, as you mentioned, build those foundations up and get the depth and breadth early on to obviously have that investment later on to pay off and work in those sexy quote-unquote areas of data, right? So so let's actually shift into the world of data now. One of the things a lot of people get confused, they use synonymously, is the words machine learning and artificial intelligence. So I would like to ask you, what is the difference between those two and how are they usually kind of interchanged and or, you know, synonymously applied?
I'm going to give a somewhat controversial take here. So lots of people refer to a simple statistical model as AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think that's necessarily incorrect. If you look at the definition of AI, you know, it's something that passes off as sort of human intelligence, but is done by a computer. Obviously, prediction and inference is a human faculty. It's intelligent. It's artificial. From my perspective, there's very little difference between machine learning and AI. AI is a term that people use that doesn't have a lot of meaning. It truly doesn't. Are we talking about artificial general intelligence? Are we talking about logistic regression? And does it matter? So I'm saying this obviously with as a company that has AI in our headline, and I think, you know, we'd love to call ourselves Bedrock NLP instead of Bedrock AI, but people don't know what natural language processing is. There's just they don't know that we're doing really advanced machine learning research in text specifically. So AI is just a more generally accepted term. I mean, my personal view is if something works, who cares what you call it?
Right. No, that makes sense. I think a lot of people kind of confuse like ML and having training models and doing that just as AI. I think that's just the assumption. And I guess when it comes to investors and stuff like that out in the market from a marketing perspective, AI makes a lot of sense. It's just a coin term, I guess, at this stage with a lot of individuals.
Right. I mean, but like, I would say that artificial general intelligence doesn't exist. Like AGI isn't a thing. So why are we, artificial intelligence to me is not a specific defined term, and it depends more on the person who's, it's very vague. You know, is a heuristics based model that passes off as being intelligent from an outsider, artificial intelligence? Sure.
Right.
Potentially.
Yeah.
That doesn't give you a lot of information about what's actually going on the back end.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would you say, like, it's like maybe in your experience, like the closest thing to an AI that we might have today? I mean, there's no real specific, as you mentioned, a real AI, but like something or a company that's really working on something interesting that would resemble something like that.
Yeah. So deep learning based language models are definitely the closest thing we have to AGI. Are you familiar with, you know, OpenAI's GPT-3, for instance?
No, that's the first time I'm hearing that. So I'd love to hear what that is.
So deep learning based language models are really cool. They allow us to, or computers to understand human language, text, speech, in a way that is much more human than it used to be. By essentially they convert words into or sentences into embeddings or vectors.
Okay.
And these embeddings contain information about the meaning of the word. So for instance, bank, financial institution, finance would all be close to each other in mathematical space. And then a riverbank would have a very different vector embedding than TD Bank, for instance. So deep learning based language models are the basis of our platform. But there's a few sort of major organizations that are working on these massive, massive language models. Mm-hmm. OpenAI is the most famous. Elon Musk is an investor. Our CTO is working on the Big Science project, which is a language model specific project, which is really cool. It's fully open source. It's multilingual. It's not just English. And, you know, it's not going to be commercialized, whereas you know, the OpenAI project is. But, you know, definitely look up these models. They're really cool. They can generate text in a way that, you know, passes off as very, very human. They also have limitations, of course, but
right.
Like, you know, what's possible is really quite cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, kind of looking into that, what other advancements in the world of data specifically are you most excited about? You know, obviously deep learning in terms of the language side of things is also an advancement, but are there other specific pieces of tech and or specific maybe frameworks that you're interested in or excited about?
Yeah, so we're big believers in a data-first approach to machine learning and to research in general. And I think that a lot of the future progress is not going to come from brand new ways of modeling, but from better training data, bigger data sets, etc. And the reason that these massive language models are in fact so effective is they've, you know, OpenAI's GPT-3 was essentially trained on all of the text on the internet ever. So it's the data piece that I find quite exciting going forward, and that's of course a big part of our own research process and our own development process, is making sure we have quality data, we have enough data as a way to ensure our models actually are effective and they work.
Right. And, you know, with excitement also comes challenges that usually exist. And especially in the data space, you know, there's been a bunch of news around, you know, things like privacy rights and stuff like that when, you know, users come to play and or anyone related to that. So what would you say are some like challenges that may exist? You know, from my experience coming from a biometric company early on, we had training models that were kind of biased when we were testing biometric recognition. It would actually recognize individuals who are Caucasians generally much better than an individual of color. And that's just because the training models were just set up that way. So you have a lot of false positives and or just failed recognition. And so what would you say are some of those kind of challenges that exist today with data models and data in general?
Yeah, that's such a great point. It blows my mind that I still hear people saying, you know, this unbiased machine learning model or this unbiased AI model, which is it's absurd. You know, machine learning and AI is inherently biased. It's generally more biased than humans. I would encourage anyone listening to this to look up Rachel Thomas. She's an AI ethics researcher. And it's someone incredible how biased language models as well. Like all of our all of the biases on the internet are sort of magnified through these language models, etc. But I think that's beyond just bias. I think in order to make good use of language models, of natural language processing, of AI in general, it's really, really important to understand limitations as well as opportunity. Because if you don't understand the limitations, you're not going to manage them. Right. I think one great example of this is, you know, language models don't understand numbers. And if you don't know that, you're going to be making the wrong decisions and you're going to be spending time where it's useless. We saw somebody trying to do a numeric specific modeling with language models, and we were just sort of sitting back and chuckling.
I totally get it. And I think there's obviously a sense of concern for the general public when it comes to like those biases that may exist, especially for, I'm giving that example again, the racially diverse groups when it comes to like certain subject matter. And then even training models, they can kind of put out the wrong information. For example, let's just say you're doing a credit check or something, and you know, a lot of these banks have AI models to kind of predict whether or not you're approved. But a lot of the times I feel like, you know, some of the stuff that goes into it is just not putting out the right output. And so, you know, there are obviously advantages to data, but then you, like you mentioned, there's disadvantages based on how you kind of have biases and or whatever the training models have kind of been put into produce, right? So I guess, you know, we'll hopefully see a change where, you know, there's more governance practices around, you know, how we kind of implement data and kind of structure the data in these models. What are your thoughts on that? Like maybe future frameworks and development, like, you know, coming from audit and stuff like that, we have SOX and all these other frameworks that exist. I know in data, there probably is some, but I don't think there's a universal framework.
Yeah, there isn't a universal framework. And, you know, I'm not an expert on data governance or AI ethics, so I hesitate to give an opinion. I do think there's something is going to be necessary, but I think the first step is just general awareness that these models do have limitations and where those limitations lie. In our current point in time, a lot of people assessing suppliers or implementing machine learning algorithms or attempting to into their business aren't necessarily aware of those limitations. And that's not just a risk from like a, you know, societal outcomes perspective, but you're much less likely to succeed in a machine learning specific project if you don't have an understanding of the limitations.
Right. And, you know, coming from the idea of AI, we're going to kind of go off the board here. What's your, because Elon talks about it all the time, but what's your idea on, or thought on the idea of singularity?
So I think something you'll notice is people who talk about singularity tend to be people who aren't actually machine learning researchers or AI researchers. They're people like Elon Musk who like stirring the pot a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are obviously at, you know, at the cutting edge of a lot of, you know, implementing machine learning in a more traditional industry and all that. And of course, we believe more than anyone in its opportunity. But I think the closer you are to the models, and I, you know, I believe Suhas, our CTO, would agree with me here, is the more you believe in the opportunity, the more you understand, you sort of become a skeptic. And yeah, I don't think any of us are considering singularity tomorrow.
I always think of like something like the Terminator or Skynet, stuff like that when it comes to that. And it's just like Elon pushing these ideas usually on these podcasts or his tweets and stuff like that. And so I just found it interesting, like how many people actually believe in this idea, at which point I think we're a very long ways from, you know, having the computer power or AI available to us to kind of overtake human mental or human conscious decision making, right? So,
and I think people forget, like, you know, Elon Musk is a smart guy and he's an expert in many things, but he's not an expert in this field.
And
people who are experts in this field aren't getting on podcasts talking about.
Yeah, it's that Joe Rogan conspiracy on. So, I mean, we've talked about, you know, the data world and kind of that transition. Now let's actually talk about the platform that you're building, Bedrock AI. So, you know, we're giving better detailed insights to a lot of users who use financial reports in this case. And so, you know, walk us through the idea and where it came from and why oftentimes information is missed by those readers.
Yeah. So I think most people think of financial information as being the financial statements. It's being numeric, it's earnings. Many are surprised to learn that the average annual report in the US is longer than Shakespeare's Hamlet. There is just an extraordinary amount of unstructured text in capital markets.
Right.
Inclusive of what are known as securities filings. And these are documents that publicly listed companies, I'm sure you know this, maybe your listeners don't, but documents that every single public company is required to file with the regulator. Mm-hmm. And they're really long, and there's a ton of them. There's four quarterly statements. There's their management information circular. You have to disclose forms related to trading. In Canada, we have annual information forms.
Right.
There's prospectuses. There's 8Ks, new releases. It's just this constant stream of information. And to give you some context, it takes me about 3 hours to read through a 10K, an annual report, in any detail.
Yeah.
So imagine that you are an equity analyst and you're covering many different companies and they're all publishing their 10K, their 10Q, whatever it is, around the same time.
Right.
What are the odds that these people are actually reading every word?
Yeah.
And the answer is they're not, which is completely understandable. And there's very few software solutions to help help financial analysts deal with information overload. And that's really, you know, what we're trying to achieve in a bit of an unconventional way.
Right.
But ultimately, our mission is corporate accountability through information transparency.
Right. And I think that's such an important tool because when I go through a 10K or any kind of financial report straight to the financials to kind of see the trend, I think as accountants, you're usually just taught, hey, just look at the financials and you get an idea of what the company's performance is. And I think a lot of people are just kind of taught to do that. And so I feel like your solution that you're bringing up really makes a huge impact in terms of consolidating like 70 plus pages of information into really synthesize important details that, you know, are oftentimes missed or, you know, people just don't have 3 hours to read about. So I think, and I think that's really important to bring in. It's a very useful tool to make better informed financial decisions.
So just another comment on that. So one of the things that we pick up indicators of downside risk, that's our current focus. But before, you know, as we were developing this technology, we spent a lot of time looking at academic models predicting fraud outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And something that's quite interesting is, you know, numeric models, so financial statement ratios, et cetera, aren't very predictive of future outcomes, future crisis, particularly malfeasance. And the reason for that is, you know, people manipulate their financial statements, whether to the fraud or just, you know, earnings management.
Accounting-wise,
they're manipulated to look normal. So if you want to have information about what's really going on, the accounting decisions being made, maybe related party transactions, credit risks, you know, the fact you can have a completely normal looking income statement and not know that the company isn't in compliance with their loan.
Right.
All of this contextual information is absolutely critical to making the right decision about, you know, that net income number.
Yeah. And I think you guys have a perfect example where I actually came across your post recently on Raphael Holdings. So, you know, I read it on your Substack in terms of how you guys kind of broke down and helped your clients avoid a bad financial situation. So could you kind of break down that whole story and how it worked out?
Yeah, so Raphael Holdings used to be a primarily a real estate company, I believe, but they'd made a really big bet on pharma.
Okay.
And the pharma outcomes, specifically here, were related to some significant regulatory milestones.
Yeah.
If they met them, good. If not, it means that, you know, that's like the majority of their business and not a great sign. So in their 10K, the dates are escaping me. They disclosed that they weren't booking a specific I was either expense or revenue line item. The details are escaping me at the moment. They weren't booking. They weren't booking a line item because they didn't believe it was probable that they would meet this milestone. And that's how accounting works. You know, if certain things aren't probable, you don't book them. And they disclosed that, you know, in accounting speak, but still in fairly plain language in their 10K. The stock was trading at about $30 a share. When the 10K came out, there was very little impact on stock price. Our algorithms obviously flagged the language related to this significant milestone, brought it to the top. We saw that, sent it out in our sort of our subscriber-only newsletter. Right. And then 10 days later, the company actually put out a press release saying, hey, we're not meeting this milestone.
Yeah.
The stock price dropped from $30 to $8.
Yeah.
That's an enormous drop in stock price. For information that was essentially already disclosed.
Right.
And it's just, you know, proof that a lot of the information in these documents is currently being missed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's such a kind of really important tool that you guys have built up. Like, that's a case in point example of, you know, note disclosure that maybe a lot of people just ignore. Or, you know, if you're not an accounting aficionado, it's just like, yeah, it might be probable, so we'll just like worry about it later kind of thing. But usually when it's not probable, it usually means it's likely never going to kind of come to fruition, from my experience at least. So
I mean, they were also saying it's not probable, but they were getting the results very soon. So like,
Yeah. So I think it's just a mix of two things. Yeah. So, I mean, you guys obviously helped your subscribers there with the, if they happen to be holding that stock. So, you know, the other thing that you guys are clearly working on is just making data more useful. So what would you say are some best practices when it comes to, you know, presenting data in a useful and digestible manner? Because, you know, again, that 10K is 70 pages long. How does that training model work in terms of choosing what are the kind of the important pieces in that information?
So the information that we're picking up right now is information that's associated with specific downside outcomes. So information that's predictive or indicative of an SEC enforcement action, a settled class action lawsuit, these types of forensic outcomes.
Right. Okay.
So one of the ways that we find interesting information or ensure that the information is interesting is by making sure there's actually a relationship with an outcome, and focusing on outcomes. So we present, we extract information that's indicative or predictive of those informations in much the same way a forensic analyst would highlight it.
Yeah.
Present it in a rank ordered list by estimated importance, so that someone doing due diligence can see the most important things first. But we've generally, one of the aspects that we take issue with other tools is, you know, financial tools showing information that likely has no actual signal to a
human. Right. Yeah.
So
okay.
One great example of that is sentiment analysis on the MD&A, for instance. We see all over the place, you know, like this management discussion and analysis, this risk section was happy or sad or litigious or this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, based on our own research, there's not a ton of signal in knowing whether or not their risk section was happy or sad.
Yeah.
And it can also give you, like, if the risk section of corporate disclosure is happy, it's probably a bad sign. Like, it's just not very helpful. So we really focus on the outcomes perspective and making sure that there is, in fact, some predictive value, both to a human and a machine.
Yeah, and I've always found it kind of odd that that whole sentiment analysis. I know a lot of companies are starting to invest in it to see how their users are reacting to certain things that they're producing. But I feel like it can be, again, obscured by just a single word if, again, the training model is not made in a way where to analyze it properly, and or like what's the future context of the person's happy, like what do you do after that kind of thing. So I think with what you guys are doing and investing in actual saying analyzing like key downside or key words that enabled them a decision maker to actually make an informed decision is really a difference maker for especially financial institution or finance people, I would say. So with that leading in, like, what's the future for Bedrock? And is it kind of staying into the financial markets or kind of even broadening past that?
Our focus is on financial text. That's what we do. We're really good at it. And that's where we see our future. You know, we find hard to find information in financial text and corporate disclosure. Our mission is corporate accountability through information transparency, and everything we do revolves around that. So we're really looking to become, you know, the Bloomberg of financial text, really that ubiquitous tool that everyone in financial services and financial analysis and equity analysis is relying on to access, parse, and understand these reams of information.
Yeah. And would you say, like, is there a future beyond, say, the enterprise aspect where you work with financial institutions, maybe for individual traders to kind of use and get your technology in terms of enabling them to help make informed decisions?
It's certainly something we talk about fairly frequently and aligns with our mission. Yeah. We do have a website called ledge.bedrock-ai.com that is open to anyone, and that's specifically around a form called an 8K. You know, at this time, our focus is institutional.
Yep.
In part just because, you know, institutional investors tend to be a lot more concerned about risk than retail investors, and that is our current focus.
And that totally makes sense. I would focus there first, obviously. That's where kind of the bread and butter of your kind of value prop goes to, so that makes total sense. So I want to kind of divulge and kind of talk about your experience of, you know, being a leader and a founder now. You know, going again, transitioning from the whole world of CPA, then you go into you know, take a modeling program or like a data program at Schulich, and now you've founded Bedrock AI. So kind of, you know, how have you developed your skills in terms of becoming a, you know, founder? I mean, you're always learning, but, and also kind of a great leader, because you're now at the stage where you're going to have to lead a lot more than, say, previously.
Yeah. Being in this company has been, so fun, and you're right that it's a very quick transition of skill sets. I originally started out doing a lot of the coding, and you know, when we were talking about this earlier in the podcast, I thought I should, you know, probably disclose that a lot of my job is no longer on that side. It's talking to investors, it's talking to customers, it's, you know, talking to the people on my team, and doing all that, and you know, the priorities of the business change very, very rapidly in the business. So in a startup specifically. So it's been a fun ride.
Yeah. And one of the things I always like to ask founders is like, how did you choose your co-founders? And how do you guys kind of, you know, work together to make decisions that are, you know, best for the business? Because, you know, there's often disagreements, maybe, you know, two founders say yes, one founder says no. So how do you come to like the best decision possible?
Yeah, so Suhas Pai, my CTO and co-founder, joined. We met through a community called Aggregate Intellect Socratic Circles here in Toronto. And you know, Suhas is, you know, he's part of Big Science Project. He's a truly brilliant natural language processing practitioner. And he's been such an incredible driver of a lot of our breakthroughs. So, you know, I think we mesh really well because I respect his technical competence completely. Right. And he respects my understanding of the domain, of the business side. And when we do have disagreements, they're generally very productive disagreements on, you know, the, can we do this even better? What's the way to go? And generally the person who's like, you know, if Suhas has a strong opinion on something technical, at the end of the day, I'm deferring to him. And I have a strong opinion on something on the business side, he defers to me, and onwards and forwards.
Yeah, no, I think that's so important. A lot of founders, or even if it's like a, let's just say you have a solo founder and they have individuals under them. I've come across individuals where they're still wanting to make those decisions, but they're not the expert within that area. And so I think what you guys are establishing early on, that culture of enabling that expert to make the final decision, that is hugely important, and it's going to help you guys, trust me, a long way through, because I've seen how that kind of issue where it just kind of cause a lot of clashes if you don't like defer to the expert, because they know what they're doing, right? They have the expertise in that area. And so kudos to you guys for implementing that pretty, very early on. So, you know, before we kind of go into our fun little lightning round at the end here, what would you say is the most challenging part of being a founder? And, you know, you're also hiring. So how's it been kind of building culture as well?
I think the most challenging part of being a founder is that, you know, you're in a high uncertainty environment all of the time. You need to be very comfortable with risk and comfortable with things going wrong because it's inevitable. You know, you've got to be scrappy. You've got to deal with it. If your supplier stops supplying you data tomorrow, you need to find a way to deal with it. And it can definitely be a bit of a mental grind, and just, you know, learning to love the pain, I think, is the trick there. On the culture side, we are a fully remote team. Mm-hmm. We really came into being just before the pandemic, which has been part of the reason we've been remote. And it's been good and bad. But the remote team culture is, you know, I think it's different. It's like you're able to focus a lot more because you end up having fewer meetings, but you don't necessarily really get that strong connection with some of your coworkers who don't necessarily live in the same city. So we, you know, we do have a culture document. It's pretty short. We have new hires read it. And we just try as best we can to enforce, a culture of openness and trust and communication, because when communication starts breaking down remotely, it can be a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, having remote first is a new, I guess, thing for a lot of individuals ever since COVID started. So, you know, it's going to take for time for people to adjust to that. But I think like coders and all individuals in engineering are kind of almost used to that environment, trying to let me focus, let me code, let me do my thing. So it almost is a positive, I say. Maybe it's like those sales and marketing individuals I usually tend to come by that are obviously more collaborative. That might mean social working spaces and stuff like that. So I've seen some companies invest in like like a WeWork or something. Surprised that they still exist, but yeah, the, you know, going to their locations and kind of collaborating there. So that's awesome. I think you guys are onto something really big. And, you know, kudos to you guys. You recently raised $1 million round as well. So congratulations on that. And, you know, future success for you and the team. So one thing I obviously like to end off with is, how do we find you? And if you're hiring anyone, how do they kind of get in touch with you?
You can find us at bedrock-ai.com or at Twitter at AIBedrock. We also have a really fun newsletter at bedrock.substack.com, which I would encourage everyone to look at. And if we are hiring, you can find that on our careers page on our website.
Sweet. Awesome. So that's the bulk of the podcast. One thing obviously we like to end off with is a lightning round to get to know you a little bit better. So I'm going to go shoot you some four questions and you have about 5 to 10 seconds to answer each one.
Exciting.
Awesome. So what's your favorite book or movie of all time?
Favorite book, Poison Wind Bible by Barbara Kingsolver. It's a fictional story about a preacher in the Congo. Yeah.
Nice. Name one company, not Bedrock, that excites you the most.
One of the other founders or other companies in our Y Combinator cohort is called Ruth Health. They're doing pelvic floor therapy and women's health, which I am very bullish on. I think it's very important and a growing need.
Yeah, we should probably reach out to those guys to share their story as well. So if you had to choose one person to have dinner with, who would that be?
Elizabeth Holmes.
Interesting. Why is that?
Oh, I just love the story. It's such a just disaster. but I, you know, she's got to be one of the best salespeople ever. The fact that, you know, she's a female founder, she's a fraudster. Fraud is a big part of what we do. And she's, you know, was able to raise and just has this natural charisma without having a product. And I find it fascinating. I find it all fascinating.
Yeah, it's funny because I was actually listening to Joe Rogan's most recent podcast yesterday. And they brought this topic up of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos and how Joe Rogan's so interested in fraud and how she kind of successfully did that. And the individual he's interviewing happens to be like an MD who almost became their chief medical officer. He was talking about how she presented him. They had a meeting together and she presented him that black box. She's like, yeah, you prick your hand and it does analysis. And him being a doctor, he's like, okay, this only tests your hemoglobin, maybe your glucose. So what's the advantage of it? And he's like, can I see inside the box? She's like, absolutely not. And he's like, I signed an NDA. There's nothing, you know, to worry about or anything. And then she's like, ever since then, I've always had bad thoughts of what could have happened with her just because she never disclosed anything. And this was like early on, like I would say like 2010 or something before things really ramped up.
Mm-hmm.
So very interesting individual. And, you know, first time we've had a guest say, hey, let's talk to a fraudster. And last question here. No, it's interesting. You know, that's cool. Last question here is one of our most controversial ones, I would say. Do you like pineapples on your pizza?
Can I abstain? I've actually never tried pineapple
on pizza. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, coming from me, I just say fruits don't belong on a pizza. I mean, tomato sauce is a base. I know it's a fruit, but, you know, pineapples, no.
All right. Well, I mean, to each their own. That's what I'll say.
Awesome. Okay, well, Chris, this finishes up the podcast. Really enjoyed the conversation, and thank you so much for coming on. And again, for our listeners, please feel free to kind of reach out to Chris and check her out at Bedrock AI. And, thanks again.
This was really fun. Thanks so much.